Hello, and welcome to the Ideal Nutrition Podcast. My name is Ed Muir, and today we have a special bonus episode. We are officially launching another podcast called Insights with Ideal Nutrition, and in today's episode, we're going to do something where Hannah Mills, who is a dietitian who works with us, she's going to be interviewing me, but she's also going to be the co-host of this new podcast, which will be an interview podcast. So we're going to double up and put this podcast on both feeds for two reasons. One, because I hope it's good content on this feed, because if you listen to this podcast, I assume you'd like this. So Hannah's going to be interviewing me. But two, because I also want to plug the new podcast. The interview style format is something that I have wanted to do for a long time, but I didn't necessarily want to do it on this feed. I want to keep doing what we are doing on this feed and have that over there. We don't advertise anything on this podcast, so this is about as close as I'll come. So I think if you like our format of doing things, you'll probably like the interview style format as well. So I'd encourage checking that out too. That is Insights with Ideal Nutrition. But apart from that, we're going to get into the episode today.
Welcome to Insights with Ideal Nutrition. I'm your host, Hannah Mills, and an accredited practicing dietitian and sports dietitian. Today, we're interviewing Aidan Muir, the founder of Ideal Nutrition, who's also an accredited practicing dietitian and sports dietitian. Aidan has had over 10 years of experience in the nutrition space, and so I thought he'd be the perfect person to start with. Today we'll be discussing how to calculate calorie requirements and then how this translates into calorie intake, as well as common criticisms about calories in versus calories out. Aidan, can you start by first explaining what calories are?
So calories are simply a unit of energy. We get calories from food and drink, and we have internal stores of calories on our body in terms of body fat is made up of calories, muscles are made up of calories, our body is largely made up of calories, so that's what I'd say calories are.
Awesome, and how would you calculate your calorie requirements?
There's a few ways to go about this. So the simplest starting point would probably be to use something like a calorie calculator, which you can find online. We obviously have one on our website, and put in your details, and that will give you an estimate, but there's a lot of an emphasis on the word estimate there, because that's just a prediction. What we actually care about is what happens over time. Let's say you were trying to figure out how many calories it takes to maintain your body weight. The way you kind of assess that is by doing something for a period of time. If you eat a certain amount of calories and you maintain your body weight, those are your maintenance calories. If your body goes up in weight, then that would be a calorie surplus. And if your body is going down, it is a calorie deficit. Probably talk through a bit more about that, but if your body weight was going down and you were in a deficit and you wanted to maintain, for example, then the next move would be to either eat more calories or reduce energy expenditure in some way.
Yeah, incredible. And why is this important for people to know?
I think it's super important for people to know because it stops you from, in the most polite way, doing silly things. Understanding that the body's made up of calories and that's part of why this plays a role, and understanding how calories in and calories out works can stop you from being misled easily. For example, if I went on TikTok and saw somebody say that they lost, I don't know, 20 kilos by having lemon water in the morning, you would instantly have to be thinking, this has to be affecting some portion of that equation. Like, is the lemon water either affecting the calories inside of things or the calories outside of things? If you were to go on and eat the exact same intake across the day, it's not affecting the energies in. Is it speeding up your metabolism or doing anything like that? It just gets you asking questions and understanding the process a little bit.
Absolutely. So it helps encompass like all those fad diets and, you know, information out there about how to change body composition. It's a good starting point to know what you require and then how those diets can then affect those factors.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Okay. And so we know that basal metabolic rate, or BMR, thermogenic effect of food, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, or your NEAT, and exercise activity thermogenesis, or your EAT, these make up the four factors of energy expenditure. Can you explain how each of these areas work?
So basal metabolic rate is basically the calories we do when we're basically just doing nothing, right? This is the calories burnt just at rest. Think things like your heart pumping, brain thinking, lungs breathing, all these things that are naturally occurring. The body doesn't burn calories for no reason. It's always doing it for a purpose. So it's burning calories through that. Another interesting one that I like to chuck out there is just little things like a kilo of body fat typically burns about 4 calories per kilo just at rest. A kilo of muscle typically burns about 12 calories per day just at rest. That therefore means if somebody was, say, Just to make the numbers real simple, if somebody was 100 kilos and 50% body fat, that's about 800 calories per day just burnt in terms of lean mass and fat mass, just due to the body maintaining those structures. So based on metabolic rate, you're always burning calories just at rest, just doing nothing. Thermic effect of food is the calories we burn in the process of eating and digesting food. On average, this is close to about 10% of our intake. So if I ate 3,000 calories, there's about 300 calories burnt through that. If I ate a really high protein, high fiber diet from mostly whole foods, it would be a higher percentage because those take a bit more energy to digest. If it was low fiber, low protein, and mostly processed foods, it would be a lower percentage, say like 5%. So we can adjust that a little bit. And then we've got non-exercise activity thermogenesis, so our informal movement. If I went for a walk upstairs to get something, that's burning calories. I talk with my hands, I move my hands when I talk, that's burning calories. People fidgeting burns calories. That takes up a decent portion of most people's energy expenditure. And then exercise is just formal exercise, formal movement, and that's always burning calories too.
Yeah, there you go. And so many people assume that once they've calculated their energy requirements, these are set for the rest of their life. I know we'll talk about metabolic adaptation shortly, but can you explain how changes in lifestyle affect your calorie requirements? So say, for example, someone was a teacher and had a very active job and then moved to more of an office job where they're more sedentary. Or on the contrary, if someone, you know, had started out with two training spouts per week and then were to increase it as they became more confident over time, how would their calorie requirements change?
So this is huge. I'm going to start with a little separate tangent first. The separate tangent that I think is a really interesting thing to kind of open this conversation is if we looked at the thermic effect of food as an example. If I went from eating 2,000 calories per day to eating 3,000 calories per day, and let's just say the thermic effect of food was set at 10%, that would go from 200 calories burnt to 300 calories burnt, right?
Mm.
So using that as an example, literally changing my calorie intake changes my calorie expenditure. That's crazy just to start off with. I think that's something that not many people are thinking about.
Yeah, so as they go into a surplus, for example, they'll probably require more calories for extra energy expenditure, and vice versa, if they go into a deficit, they'll 100%. Burn less calories from what they expect.
Literally just changing that changes your energy expenditure. Then when we're looking at like all of those things in terms of, say I went into a deficit and I lost 10 kilos, without even factoring in metabolic adaptation, there is going to be decreases in energy expenditure most likely because one, you know how I said like a kilo of fat at rest burns this amount of calories. If I lost 10 kilos of body fat, that is going to lead to less calories burnt, just maintaining that body fat. But then also if I walk 5,000 steps per day and I'm now 10 kilos lighter, I'm now burning less calories through that. And then obviously, as you mentioned with the changes in energy expenditure, just through like changes in exercise or activity and stuff like that, we burn different amounts of calories on different days. If I have a rest day, I'll be burning slightly less calories than if I have a training day. If I increase my training, I'd be burning more calories. And this is where it gets interesting when people say things like, my maintenance calories are 3,000 calories. Because we can't actively measure that perfectly. It's a moving target. It's always changing over time.
Yeah, okay. So you touched on something interesting there, just about if someone were to have a rest day, they would require less energy. And if they were to be more active, you know, on another training day, they'd require more energy. Do you recommend that people change their calorie targets each day dependent on exercise?
So yes and no. From a simple perspective, if I just want to keep things super simple, I don't change it if I want to keep things simple. We know based on research on body composition specifically, that probably doesn't matter that much if you're changing, as long as the average over time, that's pretty clear outside of maybe extremes. Like if somebody's like an elite level athlete who's training 4 hours on one day and zero on another day, maybe it's a bit different. But what I do often do, which is just one mild layer of complexity on top of that, is sometimes I'll add slightly more calories on training days where it might be like a pre-workout snack or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So say somebody burnt 600 calories in a training session, I might add 200 to 300 calories to that day. And the reason why I don't try to match it perfectly is twofold. One is, as I said, the research on body composition shows it probably doesn't matter that much. Another thing is, if you did that, you'd probably end up very hungry on rest days when you're also trying to recover from training as well. And a third thing that I'll probably chuck in there is like, we're not perfectly measuring energy expenditure too. Like I say 600 calories, but how do we know it's exactly 600 calories? Maybe it's 700, maybe it's 500. Like if you use an Apple Watch or something like that, you get a good gauge, but it's not perfect. So if you're trying to obsess about matching it perfectly, it's still not going to be perfect anyway. Mm-hmm. So instead, I might just add a little bit more to ideally make somebody feel better when they're training, but not take it to such a large swing that they're really hungry on rest days as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that it often balances out at the end of the week as well. So say, for example, you were to match your calorie requirements each day, even including an extra calorie snack prior to training, that it would balance out in terms of your weight at the end of the week. And if it were to change either in line with your goals or in a different direction of your goals, you could probably just change your total calories.
Yeah.
At the end of the day moving forward.
Yeah.
Awesome. So this is a great segue into understanding calorie intake. So we know that we have the macronutrients being fat, protein and carbohydrates providing the body with energy, but so does alcohol, sugar, alcohols and fiber. Can you explain how much energy each of these provide the body with?
So starting with the three main macros, so like protein, fats and carbs. Protein and carbs both have 4 calories per gram. Fat has 9 calories per gram. That was largely why a lot of people went in the whole low-fat diet kind of direction in, like, say, the 90s or whatever, because, like, mathematically it contains significantly more calories. Obviously, it's way more complex than that, but, like, that contains calories. Taking a second here to, like, really double down on what I'm saying, calories are made up of macros. That therefore meant if I had something that was 10 grams of carbohydrate, zero fats, zero protein, zero anything else, it would be 10 times 4, that's 40 calories. If I looked on the back of a can of Coke that had 40 grams of sugar, which is a carbohydrate, so 40 grams of carbs total, no protein, no fat, it would be around 160 calories. I know because I looked on the back of a label that's 161, and it kind of makes you ask some questions. And like one of the things is like these are rounded numbers, they're not perfect or anything like that. But you could theoretically like see the protein, fats, and carbs and not read the calories on a label and have a good indication of how many calories it would be, right? Because calories are made of macros. Taking that one step further, you said how fiber, alcohol, and sugar alcohols also contain calories. Alcohol has 7 calories per gram. Using an example, in Australia, a standard drink is 10 grams of alcohol, which therefore means the lowest calorie a standard drink can be in Australia is around 70 calories, right? Which therefore meant if you had a shot of vodka with nothing mixed with it, it's around 70 calories. Anything above that, if it was exactly one standard drink, if it's higher calorie than that, it'd have calories coming from something else like carbohydrates, right? So that's useful information. The next one is fiber. Fiber is really complex. Certain forms of fiber contain around, like for example, I think soluble fiber contains around 2 calories per gram. Insoluble fiber technically would contain calories, but we don't digest it very well. That's part of why it's called fiber, which therefore means we're not fully getting the calories out of it. In Australia, from memory, we count it as something like, I don't want to butcher it, right? But we count it as something like either 1.5 or 2 calories per gram of fiber on a nutrition panel. So if you did the experiment I just talked about with that can of Coke, but you did it with something that contains fiber, the protein, fats, and carbs added up will also undershoot the calorie target slightly because the big calories come from fiber as well. But that's a complex one. And then sugar alcohols is also complex because some sugar alcohols have almost no calories, but other ones, like let's use maltitol as an example, has about 2.1 to 2.4 calories per gram, which therefore means if you had a low carb product that replaced some sugar with maltitol, it wouldn't be listed in the carbohydrate section or anything like that. But if you read the calories, it would be factored into the calories.
Yeah, great explanation. So if someone's starting out calculating their energy requirements or their intake in a day, would you recommend that they start with an app, or would you recommend that they start looking at nutrition labels like you mentioned there, or would you recommend them have an understanding of how many calories are in each of those macros and then looking for those foods?
I'm pretty open-minded here. Like, yeah. I think you can take this in many directions. I've heard some like people in the nutrition space say things like, I think everybody should track at some stage of their life to give them an understanding of this. And I see that logic, but then I'm also like, we also have the research on how tracking is linked with disordered eating as mm-hmm. well. And the like linkage with that is quite strong. And that's where I've got like the different strokes for different folks kind of thing, where it's like, some people can track and it's not an issue. It actually just improves their life. It's fine. Other people, it takes them down a pathway or it encourages them to go a little bit down a pathway we don't want to do. And this is where it's complex for me because I do talk about calories a fair bit. But I think you can take everything I say about calories and then apply it without even necessarily tracking. Like, for example, if I say that a calorie surplus leads to weight gain over time, for example, and some guy is listening to me and they want to get jacked and they're like, they're skinny and they want to gain size, they could take that information and be like, okay, I've maintained my weight for the last 12 weeks, but I want to be gaining size. Based on what Aiden's saying, all I need to do is eat slightly more than what I'm currently doing. If I ate 20% more, now I'd be in a calorie surplus and gaining size over time. Mm-hmm. You can apply a lot of these concepts without necessarily tracking. And I do think, like, with the food labels and stuff like that, having context around that is a useful thing. Like, if you know roughly how many calories you're aiming for, even if you're not necessarily tracking, that then adds context to being like, if you have, let's say you were aiming for 2,000 calories per day, and you went to Woolworths and you got, say, a MuscleChef meal, and there were options. There was one that was 300 calories, 400 calories, 500 calories, 600, and 700. If you aim for 2,000 a day, 700 might be a little bit large for a meal, because if you had two meals that were 700, you're at 1,400, you only have 600 left for breakfast and all the snacks for the day. If you found one that was like below that 300 listed, like there is some that are like 250. If you made your lunch 250, and let's say you made your dinner 250, but you're aiming for 2,000, you're only at 500, and you now have 1,500 less to go, kind of thing. Even without actively tracking, it adds context around these things.
Yeah, I like that. So you have the options of tracking your calories, say, for example, in MyFitnessPal or Easy Diet Diary. You have the second option of calculating how many calories you require in a day and then working backwards from there using nutrition labels and things like that to be like, okay, cool, if I require 2,000 calories in a day, I have 500 for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then 500 left to play around with my snacks. And then the third option from there maybe would be having a look at like the balance of your plates, would you say?
100%, yeah, heaps of options there.
Yeah, awesome. So I know that you've mentioned on your podcast about how to calculate your energy requirements for a surplus or a deficit, but can you describe briefly how that works when understanding your energy requirements in a day?
So starting off with, we get calories externally from food and drink, and we have stores on our body. And each day we burn a certain amount of calories. That number changes each day, obviously. But let's pretend for the sake of this, you've burnt a certain amount of calories for a day, and you've eaten more than you've burnt. That has to get stored somewhere. Calories are simply a unit of energy. Energy cannot just come out of nowhere. It can't just be created out of nothing, but it also can't disappear either. It's not a controversial statement to say that if you burn a certain amount of calories and you've eaten more than you've burnt, that has to be stored somewhere. We have storage forms in our body. We have muscle, fat, and glycogen. We have finite stores of glycogen. Most people can store, say, the equivalent of around 2,000 calories of glycogen if they're like near fully loaded on glycogen. We can gain muscle slowly over time. I wish it was a quicker process, but we gain muscle slowly over time. And we have a pretty much infinite storage about the amount that we can store as body fat, right? But if you had a surplus of calories available, it has to be stored somewhere. That's why a surplus leads to gaining weight over time.
Amazing. And how does the opposite work with a deficit?
That's why I started off by saying nobody's going to say that first thing's controversial. The second part is, with a deficit, it's just the opposite thing. If you have burned a certain amount and you have eaten less than you have burned, it has to come from somewhere. There is a deficit there, and you have physically, quote unquote, burned that amount of calories. If you haven't gotten enough through food and drink, it has to come from your internal stores. So your body will be pulling from glycogen, muscle, or fat. And as I said, there is only a finite amount of glycogen you can store. Muscle, ideally, you're holding onto as much of that as you can. So ideally, a decent portion of that's coming from body fat. So that's why a deficit works. One of the things that makes that kind of a little bit more controversial is the amount that we burn on a daily basis is always changing, right? And as I said, like, how much we eat changes how much we burn and everything like that. But that's why I've kept it simple by saying, if you burn a certain amount, you eat less than you burn. That's why there's a deficit. That's why it's pulling from your body's internal stores, and body weight goes down over time.
Yeah, amazing. And I know that you like to pull from the stat quite often that 1 kilogram of body fat holds 7,700 calories. So if someone were to want to lose a kilo of body fat in a week, how would they then work backwards from there with that?
Yeah, great question. So let's keep this simple and say what you eat doesn't affect how many calories you burn to start off with. If you went into a 1,000 calorie deficit every single day for 7 days, that's 7,000 over the course of a week. That's near enough to 7,700. That'd be like, oh, you'd lose a kilo of body fat if you did that. The tricky thing with this is what we eat changes how much we burn. For example, the thermic effect of food would drop. Maybe non-exercise activity thermogenesis drops because we're a bit fatigued because we're eating less food and everything like that. How much we eat is changing these kind of things. What we would need is a quote-unquote net deficit of 7,700 over the course of a week, which would be after accounting for any changes in energy expenditure. That's how we get to that. And the other thing that skews this a little bit is when you typically start a deficit, your body weight drops at the start, often because glycogen stores are decreasing, water weight stores are decreasing, you're eating less food, so there's less food weight in your stomach. So you'd often see scale weight drop quicker at the start as well, even if that's not all necessarily body fat.
That's so good to know, because I know I hear a lot of clients say, I was losing so much weight at the start and now it's plateauing, like what's going on? But that's a really good explanation there. So now going into unpacking common criticisms around calories in versus calories out. I know a lot of people claim that they have a damaged metabolism after long periods of yo-yo dieting or just being in a deficit. Can you explain what's going on here?
So metabolic adaptation is a thing. It is the concept of your body down-regulating certain functions in response to being on lower calories. And in the process of down-regulating these functions, calorie expenditure typically drops a little bit in the process. And the technical definition of metabolic adaptation is when basal metabolic rate decreases by more than the formula would predict in response to weight loss. For example, as I said, if you lost like 10 kilos, you would expect that there would be a reduction in basal metabolic rate because of the loss of 10 kilos. But if it's more than a formula predicts, the logic is that what if the body down-regulates certain stuff? Example, what if my heart rate slowed down more than expected or whatever? Or what if my heart rate did slow down in response to the calorie deficit? Now my body's spending less calories on my heart. What if my core body temperature decreased a little bit? Because your metabolism warms up your body as well. Now your body's spending less calories on that because it's not the highest priority. That's kind of logic there. I extend metabolic adaptation to also talk about other functions, for example, that non-exercise activity thermogenesis. What if somebody who's on lower calories, they start moving less because they feel a bit more fatigued? That's another factor that I'd chuck into there. With the damaged metabolism kind of concept, there is this concept people talk about with starvation mode, and there's a few things that we can unpack there. The first one is that in research, we never see people on low calories not losing weight. That's not something that has ever been seen in controlled environments. That's a bit of a starting point. Outside of research, I hate talking about this, but we see like starvation camps and stuff like that. We see everyone on low calories losing weight, which then raises questions about being like, why does that happen in the real world? The first thing that I touch on with that metabolic adaptation first is that your body can only downregulate so hard. We see that when people have been on low calories for an extended period of time, if we look at research on metabolic adaptation, we often see reductions of like 100 to 200 calories in basal metabolic rate. It's nothing crazy. We also see that it is adaptation in that it goes in both directions. If somebody were to increase their calories after a period of time on lower calories, it goes in the other direction. Every study that we have ever seen on metabolic adaptation has shown that apart from one. And it's very clear that the body cares more about what we've done recently than what we did, say, 5 years ago. The one study that hasn't shown that is the Biggest Loser study, which was done, it came out in like, say, I don't know, butcher it, maybe like 2015 or something like that, where they found that 6 years after the first season of the Biggest Loser, a lot of the participants had a basal metabolic rate that was around 500 calories lower than what you'd expect, even though they had roughly on average regained to near their original starting weight. That looks like this concept of metabolic damage, but there's a few things that I'd unpack there. One is that the total daily energy expenditure was still over 3,000 calories per day. When people are typically referring to metabolic damage in themselves, they're not really talking about that. Like they're usually talking about quite low calorie intakes. And two, it's a massive outlier of a study with a small sample size. And even then, the author, Kevin Hall, amongst others, he has done a reanalysis of their study, trying to find an explanation for why that happened. And one of the things that they came back at is a lot of the participants who had maintained decent weight loss were doing heaps of exercise still. And there's this logic called the constrained energy expenditure model, which is basically like, if you do heaps of exercise, other components of your energy expenditure might drop a little bit to compensate for that. For example, if I went out and ran a marathon, maybe my body's going to spend less calories on incidental movement because I'm kind of drained from that. Mm-hmm. Maybe my body's going to downregulate other functions. That's not necessarily my best explanation of why that kind of occurred in that study, but it is just pointing out that that's one outlier study. With the explanations for why this happens in the real world, I don't like going too far down that rabbit hole because we don't know, right? Like, we don't know what people are doing in the real world. I start off by saying, in studies where all food is provided, we never see this. In the real world, we have a lot of data showing that people do typically, on average, underreport their calorie intake. That's a big thing. But if we can't see everything that's going on, it's quite hard to rely on that type of data, which is why I focus on the stuff that's like, whenever we see all the food provided, this is what happens.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. So would you say that each area of energy expenditure coming from BMR, thermogenic effect of food, non-exercise activity thermogenesis and exercise activity thermogenesis would downregulate while in a deficit?
To a degree, yeah. So like basal metabolic rate, as I said, doesn't really downregulate that much, but it typically does a little bit, more than you predict due to this. Thermic effect of food, not due to metabolic adaptation, but simply just due to eating less total food, you'll see a decrease there. Incidental movement, we typically see drop off, but there is ways around that. For example, if you made a conscious effort to stay more active, you could stay more active. If somebody like had a step count that they were aiming for or anything like that gets into semantics about being like, is a step count now no longer incidental movement because you're doing it for a purpose? But theoretically, you can offset a little bit. With exercise, typically that's going to decrease for a few reasons, because if you kept doing the exact same routine and you were losing weight, you'd probably be burning less calories because you're moving less mass. For example, if I went for a 2K run at 90 kilos and then continued doing a 2K run at 75 kilos, I'd be burning more calories at 90 because I'm doing more work at 90 because I'm carrying more mass as I'm running.
Yeah, right. And so when you're in a deficit, all those factors downregulate. Can you explain if that means that the metabolism is broken or if this is reversible?
Nah, that's why I went through that whole like Biggest Loser kind of thing, because everything outside of that study has made it really clear that it is very reversible. It's adaptation, because if you increase your calories, all of these things will upregulate in response to that. And taking away from metabolic adaptation, for example, we even see this happen very quickly. Like firstly, there's one study where they overfed people by 1,000 calories, and some people's energy expenditure increased by like 700.
Yeah.
Like pretty much instantly, right? They just started fidgeting more, moving more, etc. Like we see this stuff happen really quickly. There's a study with a title that I don't really like, but it's really important on this topic, called something along the lines of metabolic adaptation is an illusion that is no longer present after dieting. It's something along those lines, right? But 4 weeks after a fat loss phase, they tried to measure metabolic adaptation. They could no longer really measure it, whereas they could measure it a little bit at the end of the diet. And the thing that kind of annoys me a little bit about that title is that is our understanding of metabolic adaptation. It is something that gets reversed pretty quickly. But the point that they were making is that it's just not something that's likely to be affecting you down the line.
Yeah, so just on that, do you have a rough timeline of how long it would take for metabolic adaptation to downregulate, and then vice versa, after someone's been in a deficit for a while, how long it would take to reverse and come back to maintenance level?
It's hard, because some things happen instantaneously, like the thermic effect of food thing kind of talked about, that happens straight away, right?
Yeah.
But how long does it take for you to suddenly start moving a little bit less? Like some of that happened, like if I ate half the amount of calories I normally eat today, towards the end of today, I'll be moving differently, right?
Yeah.
But if I did that every single day for 6 weeks, I would definitely be moving differently in 6 weeks' time, right? So like some stuff happens over time. The stuff like the decrease in heart rate and all of this stuff like probably happens over the course of a few weeks. It's not instantaneous. In the other direction, though, there's a few clues that we can kind of pull on. One is that there was a study by Jackson Pios where they did a diet break every fourth week over the course of 15 weeks versus another group that just dieted for 12 weeks. And they didn't really find any difference in metabolic adaptation. So it's like 1 week of a diet break in that study found no difference. But the thing that's kind of tough with that is like they were specifically measuring basal metabolic rate, which, as I said, that doesn't really change that much anyway. It's only a couple hundred calories maximum, but they didn't find a difference there. But then we've got that other study that I said that had a 4 week break after the fat loss phase where they measure it, and they found no difference. So if I was looking at clues based off those two studies as an example, I would say somewhere in between that window is how long it takes to reverse. But then there's other scenarios, like what if you dieted for 20 weeks straight? Would it take longer? I would wager it would take a little bit longer, but I don't think it's something that's going to take exceptionally longer than that.
Yeah, great. So if someone's planning to do a deficit for a long period of time, you probably would recommend they have maintenance phases to reverse that metabolic adaptation?
If somebody's going to do a very long deficit, likely yes. Depends on the length of the deficit. With the metabolic adaptation thing, like I think for a very long deficit, yes. But there's also other reasons. Like I think relationship with food. I think fueling training well. I think hunger often gets out of hand if we stick in a deficit every single day for a long period of time. I feel like people feel like they're restricted and stuff like that. And this is a small variable in that I would consider doing that. It's kind of hard because sometimes people get on a really good roll and I just want to kind of let them run with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But other times it makes sense. And then if somebody had like a lot of weight to lose, I like the other idea of having maintenance phases, just to have a period of time of seeing what it feels like to be eating a decent amount of food at maintenance calories, because obviously at the end of it, the goal is to maintain body weight. So the metabolic adaptation is a factor. I just think there's so many factors that also matter there.
Yeah, great. So it's not vital that we do that for a deficit, but could be an important factor for multiple other reasons as well.
Yeah.
Great. So transitioning, also in practice, we hear a lot about hormones affecting metabolism. We hear about different populations, for example, those with medical conditions such as hyperthyroidism or PCOS, people going through menopause, or those going through stressful times, feeling that the rise in cortisol actually affects their weight loss. Can you explain your thoughts on how hormones affect metabolism?
So this can be a massive topic, so I'm going to just hone in like some key points. The first one is, even if we were just looking at it from a calories perspective, hormones affect both sides of the calories in and calories out kind of equation. Hormones affect calories in because we have hunger hormones that influence how much we want to eat, right? For example, what if you were just like not hungry one day and that was related to hunger hormones? You'd probably eat less. What if another day you were like ravenously hungry? You'd probably eat more. That's the less interesting side of this equation. The more interesting side is the energy out. If we looked at, say, thyroid hormones, for example, if thyroid hormones are like suppressed, if they're lower, total daily energy expenditure typically drops. One of the things I said earlier is that the body doesn't burn calories for no reason. That therefore means if calorie expenditure is dropping, there's a reason for it. And with the thyroid hormones thing, the thyroid controls a lot of functions in the body. It influences a lot of functions in the body. If somebody had Hashimoto's, for example, so that's hypothyroidism, there's often a lot of symptoms that occur with that. Using examples, people often get brain fog. They often have poor digestion or slow digestion. They often feel colder and they often feel fatigued. That manifests in a reduction in calories because the body is spending less calories on those functions, basically. And in the research, the largest reduction in total daily energy expenditure I've seen with Hashimoto's is a reduction of about 15%. I want to be really clear here that there's a few reasons why I'm chucking out that number. One of the clear things is that's small sample size research. Like it's like maybe a few hundred people maximum across all of these studies, which therefore means I believe in the world out there, there's people who have more than a 15% reduction, right? But the reason why I say that's the largest that we've seen is it's relevant because it isn't a massive, massive reduction, right? If I had Hashimoto's and was having a difficult time losing weight, I would want to address it, right? But I would also want to address it for all the symptoms, far more than the 15% reduction. Yeah. It's like they both matter, but I'd be trying to address the symptoms and then this would come along for the ride, right? That's interesting information. Any other hormones or anything else like we want to touch on that? Like, I really just want to clarify that it's like this is affecting both sides of the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe briefly just on menopause.
Yeah. So like menopause, it's a massive one, right? There's one study that this is going to sound dumb, right? But I'm going to start with this and then we're going to work backwards from this. Herman Ponsa did a study that found that between the ages of 20 and 60, when you accounted for a bunch of variables such as muscle mass, activity, overall body weight and stuff like that, that there was no difference in metabolic rate between the ages of 20 and 60. Prior to 20, people are growing, so obviously there's differences there. After the age of 60, the reason for a drop-off was changes in organ function declining, so spending less calories on that. But between 20 and 60, there was no difference. And obviously, menopause is occurring in there. The reason why I'm going to say that sounds dumb is because a lot of variables change. That research also found that there was no difference between men and women when you accounted for those variables. But then you can state the obvious, being like, most guys eat more than most girls. Mm. And it's because, yeah, there are different variables. They might have more muscle mass, there's differences in activity, there's differences in so many things, right? And then if we look at it being like, okay, if all variables are equal in terms of body composition and everything like that, and in terms of overall activity, how would menopause be playing a role? It affects everything. Body composition can change due to changes in hormones, for example. Appetite can change due to changes in cravings and stuff like that as well. Obviously, pre-menopause and post-menopause, there's going to be changes in that. Activity levels can change. Something that I'm thinking about that, like, this is probably the smallest detail, and anybody listening to this is probably going to think this isn't a massive thing, right? But, like, or in relation to everything else. But, like, what if you get hot flashes and then your sleeping sucks because, yeah, like, obviously that's going to affect everything. There's so many things about menopause that will affect everything about this kind of equation as well. And that whole research I kind of just talked about is like if all variables are equal, but the variables will change and menopause will change those variables.
So indirectly it would change
very much
metabolism,
so.
But not directly with the hormone fluctuations. Yeah. Yep, that explains a lot. I know you have a podcast delving into everything about hormones and the effects on metabolism and things like that. So if you guys are interested, I would head over to the Ideal Nutrition podcast. But other than that, is there anything else you'd like to touch on today about energy balance, Aiden?
I don't think so. Not specifically about energy balance. I think we covered a lot.
Okay, awesome. Well, that wraps up the first podcast of Insights with Ideal Nutrition. Thanks for listening.